Good afternoon. We're going to call the joint meeting of the Senate Energy and Resources Committee to order. We do have present a quorum. We have Senators Wagner, Senator Kukesh, Senator French, Co-Chairman Willikowski, Senator Hoffman, and we're expecting the others. We have one item on the agenda today, and that's a presentation by Denali Biodiesel. And just another example of innovating Alaskans out there looking at energy. And my co-chair was just mentioning to me a reminder that this is an example of a lot of the stuff we've been talking about taking a feedstock and converting it into liquid fuel. And you can do it with coal, you can do it with gas, and in this case, you're going to talk about fish waste, which is very exciting. Certainly in Alaska, we have a lot of that. So without further ado, I'll go ahead and let you make the presentation. Tell us about biodiesel.
Thank you, Senator. By way of introduction, my name is Greg Mick. I'm the CEO of Denali Biodiesel, and this is my Vice President, Scott McCormick. We are a Alaska-based disabled veterans-owned corporation, and is it not working now?
It doesn't work now.
Well, the program did work just 30 seconds ago. Shalon tried to send this as an email.
Click on this. All right, that's there.
Oh. There we go. We are currently the only licensed commercial biodiesel producer in the state of Alaska. In 2009, we briefed yourself, Chairman McGuire, as well as the governor's office regarding a federal Department of Energy grant submission that we were working on for letters of submission. And during this briefing, we also went and talked to the governor's office, then Governor Sarah Palin, and met with her advisor, Joe Balash. During this meeting, we were asked to consider a biodiesel refinery for a solution to reduce and ultimately eliminate the PCE program. Biodiesel, just by way of introduction, biodiesel is a fuel containing many of the same traits as conventional diesel fuel. There are no changes that need to be made to equipment to run biodiesel. It is a direct replacement for petroleum diesel. It's made from high-quality oils through a manufacturing and refining process referred to as either acid esterification as a pretreatment and then transesterification for the actual conversion of the oil. In this case, we're using pure fish oil that is derived from fish waste. We take the fish waste and it's processed into very small pieces, then ground up even further. We run it through a separator that separates the oil, the water, and the solids. We then take and centrifuge the oil, and then it is then run through the biodiesel process of transesterification. As a side note, a lot of your colleagues have mentioned, well, this is being done out in Dutch Harbor, and it is not. What is done out in Dutch Harbor currently is they take fish oil, refined fish oil, and blend it with petroleum diesel. That's a diesel blend, but that is not biodiesel. Biodiesel is not a blend of oils with petroleum diesel. Background. Further background, the state of Alaska funds up to 32. We found out today it's actually went up to $40 million in PCE subsidies for high energy costs in the rural areas. And as you, I'm sure you're all well aware, that's increased steadily, approximately 25% to 33% yearly. And as a side note, as a reference, everybody remembers the jet here in Alaska a couple years ago. It's equal to about 16 to 18 of those. That cost. Many of the rural areas have substantial fishing operations, able to produce anywhere from 100 to 600,000 gallons of fuel annually from the fish waste. Most of the fish waste now is discarded. It is ground up and discharged back into the ocean. And this could be made into valuable biodiesel fuel for power, heating, transportation, or energy generation, and any excess fuel that the communities produce could then be used as a commodity.
There were a number of challenges. When we were asked to undertake this study to determine how we could eliminate the PCE through a biodiesel solution, we were given access to information about how much the fish harvest is in various areas and how much the PCE funds are spent in specific areas. And we matched those up so we determined which were the high potential areas for reducing PCE cost and for producing biodiesel for their own consumption. The size and the location of many of the rural communities' fishing operations limits the potential that you would normally have for the type of commercial operation that we run. We run an operation in a city like Chugiak or Anchorage or the one we're building in Fairbanks, which has access to transportation, to large commodities of methanol, to technical talent to service the areas. That's not available in the areas that we're looking at. And so the solution that we were looking to propose had to consider that as a challenge. So that's what we call the infrastructure, the ability to have a training, a certification, a laboratory capability, the ability to have one or two people to work as field staff for the startup and shutdown because the fishing season is only 6 months. It doesn't run 12 months of the year. To have a number of other sort of unique boundary conditions, whereas the major fisheries that we work with already may use a centrifuge and processes to grind up their fish. In many of the rural communities, they're using machetes and tables to cut up the pieces to a form. So converting the fish waste into a usable product that you can extract the oil out of, for one thing, is an issue, and it was a challenge to look at the engineering design for that, as well as what you do with the de-oiled fish waste itself. Many places that don't have a permit from the EPA to dump more than a certain amount into the water, they have to convert it to fish meal, most of which they do, to our understanding, that they operate it at a loss. So there's a number of things you can make out of that besides fish meal that are somewhat more valuable commodities, so we looked at that as part of the solution as well. This little cartoon is just sort of an idea of the process that has to go on. You take the oil, you filter it to get out all of these small particulates that would affect the process. Once you've done that, you come out with an oil as well as this filtered, de-oiled fish solid, if you will. The oil then goes through a biorefinery process that Greg described, and out of that you get two things. You get biodiesel and you'll get glycerol. Now, glycerol is about 10% of the product, and you can make a number of things out of that. Most likely you can make out of it as a soap product. You can make glycerin soap out of it, which is a very valuable commodity. And it's especially useful when you look at the 132 communities that we were asked to look at. There's about 25 that are likely for produced biodiesel, but a number of the others could use it as a cottage industry for making products out of the glycerol itself. They can make soaps, they can make polyols, they can make a variety of products.
So on this point, we have to note Greg's wife, who's an OBGYN, brilliant lady, takes the glycerol from your production and makes it into soaps and has given me a couple to try, and they're fantastic. She does them into different shapes with, you know, little packaging, good smelling, and make your skin feel great. So it's...
I'm sure she'll appreciate that.
It's fantastic.
Chief of Urology at Alaska Native Medical Center.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Yes?
Could you tell me what you do with the filtered solids? And how much is that? How much of that comes out of this when you get through for a typical day, maybe?
It depends on the size, but let me kind of give some numbers, unless you wanted to answer that.
Well, through the chair, Senator Kukesh.
Kukesh.
Filtered solids, I mean, for an example, the 25 million pounds that we were looking at, the waste in the Kenai Peninsula, approximately, that would yield approximately 1 million gallons of biodiesel fuel. The remaining 19 to 20 million pounds would then be converted into a fish-based or a fertilizer product.
It's called a liquid hydrolysate. It's like a soil amendment. You would put a product such as formic acid to stabilize it and prevent any pathogens from forming. And then it can be shipped or handled, and then it's used at a second level processing to convert it into a liquid that goes for about 5 to 7 dollars a gallon. So out of 20 million pounds, you would get about $12 million worth of liquid hydrolysate.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just to follow up, I just wanted to, it's interesting to me because I thought it was just waste. But now that I understand it's not, that's interesting.
Through the Chairman, yes, it is considered waste because there really hasn't been a large understanding of how to process this material. There are only three locations in the world where fish waste is made into to fuel. One of them is in Honduras, which is a tilapia farm. It's been in operation for a couple of years. It has a somewhat crude process. They fuel all of their buses in Honduras with biodiesel. A Finnish company, VTT, is building a $40 million plant in operation in Vietnam, which, based on the economic differences, that's equivalent to about a $65 million operation anywhere else. And they're using the large channel catfish. And the third one is at the Chubiak plant, where we've processed this and qualified the oils and the product down with the National Biofuel Energy Lab.
Just so we're clear, I was talking about the filtered solids.
And the filtered solids depends on, actually, the way the fish is harvested, the amount of solids that come out of that is generally about 85 to 90% of whatever the volume of fish waste.
Oh, okay.
So if you have 25 million pounds or 2.5 million pounds, you get about 2 million pounds of fish waste. To make it into a liquid hydrolysate, it's about 1/8 of that. You move it down. You can't actually use it as it stands. If you mix it with peat moss, it's used in California for what's called, they call topsoil. So they re-topsoil desert areas and low quality earth with a combination of fish waste and topsoil and the peat moss, and they use it as topsoil. And it's a potentially wonderful ingredient because the chemical fertilizers that are used, only about 20% of the chemicals are actually absorbed into plants, whereas with the fish filtered solids, 100% of it is absorbed into the plants. So,
Senator French and then Wagner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions, and the first is, can you remind me again what a liquid hydrolysate is?
It is the conversion, through the chair, excuse me, it is the conversion of the de-oiled fish waste. Once you take the oil and the glycerol out, you have a dry product. That dry product is then converted through another chemical process where you basically stick it in a tank and add another chemical, and it decomposes, you add a little water to it, and that makes a liquid. The chemical term for it is, we call it liquid fish fertilizer, but the technical name is a hydrolysate.
I'd stick with fish fertilizer, at least for me, and I don't know about the rest of the group.
Senator Wagner.
I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry, yeah, Senator French.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I the real question I wanted to ask was, and it kind of follows up on Senator Kukesh's, a chart that showed me what is happening now in fish plants across the state and what sort of the relative values of the waste products are versus what this process would do regarding the usage of, say, you know, a million pounds of fish and the relative values of the filtered solids and the oil and so forth would be illuminating for me to know what's out there, what's happening now, and the economic value, what's happening now, and what would happen if we adopted something like this, and what would be the economic value of the fish waste under the different streams here would help me sort of get a grip on what's possible. So,
Senator French, through the chair, I don't have a chart for you today to address that. I can give you a couple of quick facts in that most of the plants that do have any kind of meal plant operation because they are in excess, they have too much in excess of what can be dumped and ground and discharged back into whatever a body of water they're near, most of those plants operate at a loss. The reason they're making the meal is because they can't dump any more back in the ocean. And it's going to get worse because the EPA has pretty much put these places on notice that it's not decomposing, it's not being consumed by other aquatic life, so it's building up in the ocean floor, and they've pretty much put them on notice that in the very near future, grind and discharge is not going to happen. So it's going to be, they're going to have to get rid of, which means they're either going to have to turn to someone like us and, you know, allow us to take more all of the fish waste for conversion to a biofuel, or it's going to have to go in landfills. So, but as far as the economic aspect of it, it's our understanding that most of these places, if not all, are operating at a loss just simply because they have to do something with the waste.
So it's costing them, you know, $2 a pound to make fish meal they can only sell for a dollar?
For the year, about 10 to 15 cents a pound.
Okay, okay, thanks.
Yeah, good question. Senator Wagner.
What kind of nutritional value is in the filtered solids? In other words, could that be used for feeding pigs or poultry or some other type of livestock and have a secondary industry off the back end of one of these processes?
Mr. Chair, if I may, the filtered solids have to be stabilized. Otherwise, pathogens form in the decomposing fish, if you will.
Yeah.
So you could use it for those types of things if you use it immediately within a day or two. Or if you're able to store it in a colder area, which many of the regions we're talking about at the end of the season, they have the ability to keep it frozen for up to 3 months, and that's perfectly usable for feeds. But given that it would have to be shipped many places outside these, if you're looking at quantities that have to go outside the community, it's not really usable as any kind of a feedstock. It's only really good as a soil amendment or as a fish fertilizer or as a fish meal.
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, I think one of the misnomers that people say, they hear feedstock, and that it creates a confusion. That is an industry standard term for any material that is used to convert.
I know that.
He knows.
Okay,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah.
I was more referring to feed for livestock, and just wondering. So I understand what you said, but what happens if you run it through a dryer?
Yes, if you
and then in a dried state, you could store it and feed it, because you don't have to have it moist or anything to feed to poultry or cattle or pork.
And Senator Wagner, through the chair, that's basically what a lot of these places do with the fish meal, which they're creating at a loss, but that's what the fish meal is then dried and further ground up and stored or sold on the open market.
And through the chair, sir, the other issue is that for fish meal, you don't really have to require any mineral or vitamin additives, whereas most, and I haven't done any farming for 50 years since I was a child, but most of the actual feedstocks that go to different species, whether it's goats or sheep or cows, require specific additives to be added to a fish meal product.
Mm-hmm.
For pigs, it doesn't.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. Does it have an odor at all, the solid?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins. You're talking about the filtered solids after we take the oil out?
Whatever the waste is, that what we're talking about.
Well, if you take the waste fish right from the from the fish plants, yeah, it smells like dead fish. I mean, it's now once it goes through the once we grind it and take the oil out, take the water out, and dry it, pretty much the smell is eliminated.
Yeah. And I hope it.
The biodiesel itself definitely has no smell.
Yeah, I hope it really stinks. I'm one of those guys that sling arrows. and bears love to come to fish odor. So I'm thinking of the Sportsman's Warehouse. They would,
so you would like me to change my statement and say that it really smells bad?
Well, it would be marketable. The Sportsman's Warehouse makes a big business off bear bait in my neighbors. It's hard to come by other alternatives. So good news.
You guys don't happen to have any of it with you here?
No, okay. Alaska Airlines really frowns on liquids.
That's right. So I have some in my office in Anchorage at the LAO there. If any of you guys are through this session and certainly after, come in and take the lid off and feel free to smell. It's amazing. It's completely odorless. So it's there in a mason jar.
And Chairman, where I can add to that, not only is it odorless, but you can actually drink your body weight in it safely. It's non-toxic. I wouldn't recommend it. It doesn't taste real good. But unlike petroleum-based products, it's completely safe.
It does have some adverse digestive processes on it. But it won't kill you.
Yeah. Got it.
Okay. Go try that right next.
Yeah.
If I may.
Continue, yes.
One of the things that we have, and we put this picture up, I'm sure everyone knows what fishery waste looks like. This is sort of the picture of it. One of the boundary conditions for saying how would you solve this problem is there's a couple of unique things that have to happen in a remote area, whereas you don't, now you may have a fishery operation where you have a couple of gentlemen at the end of the line chopping up the fish into it with machetes to process about the amount that would make it viable for a community to generate their own fuel. You need something that's shown at the upper right-hand corner, which is that's more commonly seen at high-end community parks. But basically what the equipment is that's inside of here is essentially a high-speed garbage disposal. It'll process about a ton an hour and allow you to process into a slurry that can then be heated and pressed to remove the oil much more efficiently. It also would actually speed up the process from talking to Fish and Games and a couple of the villages. Soap making, it could be done by molds with home equipment, or it can be done, depending if there was a high volume of it, and we're talking more than 10 to 20,000 gallons of it, there's equipment that can be bought to process it into soap or other polyols, other products. And lastly, how the fish waste, the actual de-oiled dried solids would be processed. There's a picture here on the bottom left of what the tank system looks like. This system costs about between $100,000 and $150,000 depending on the size. And this type of system basically tanks and processes and creates a soil amendment in a very passive fashion. It doesn't require any difficulty. One of the things that when we looked at what this opportunity was, is that we would propose that the means to substantially reduce and potentially eliminate the fuel subsidy, at least at the dollar volume it exists at today, is that when we looked at these top 25 communities, they could produce a substantial amount of biodiesel in the order of around 4 million gallons annually. The cost of diesel fuel runs between $4 and $10 a gallon between the different regions. So adopting that value, that's somewhere an Anchorage of about $16 million to a more remote area of about $40 million worth of fuel just from those areas.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Hoffman.
The biodiesel, is that a substitute for diesel, or can gasoline be made of this product as well?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, it is a substitute for diesel. Gasoline is not produced from this, but it is not strictly just diesel engines like vehicles. It can be run at home heating, anything, generators, anything that burns diesel fuel can burn biodiesel at 100% compatibility.
And is it BTU equivalent to a gallon of diesel?
A gallon of diesel has approximately 140,000 BTUs, and a gallon of biodiesel produces approximately 134,000 BTUs. The additional benefit to biodiesel is that when you run it in any internal combustion engine, the lubrication properties are far exceed any traditional diesel, to include number two, number one, or unfortunately the ultra-low sulfur stuff now that is just tearing engines apart. You introduce biodiesel and the lubrication is far superior. You're finding much longer engine wear, and it's much better for your engine.
So this could be used as a substitute for low sulfur?
Absolutely
used as a substitute for low sulfur diesel engines, yes.
If I may, through the chair, add something to that. One of the things that concerns us, because we do this because it's not just a good fuel, but it's good for the environment. By federal law, beginning in 2010, oil companies are able to deliver the lowest quality fuel, the high sulfur fuel, to the remote regions because they justified a couple years ago and had it passed into federal law that it was too expensive for them to convey two different kinds of fuels. Our concern is that adds more pollution to the environment, and we'll get into the capabilities of this fuel a little bit later in the presentation.
So you're saying there's a rural exemption for low sulfur in rural Alaska this year?
Senator Wagner.
Well, yeah, my question is going to be, so if I'm having to burn low sulfur diesel in my boat, number one, the performance of the engine not nearly as good as with the higher sulfur diesel. So you're your performance going to be about the same as number one or number two diesel that I've put in. Where can I get some of your product to try in my boat?
Through the chair.
How much per gallon?
Through the chair, Senator Wagner. I generally attempt to keep the price of the biodiesel 25% less than pump diesel. The one contributing factor and tying factor is that the one chemical that I have to use to make biodiesel is methanol, and methanol is derived from petroleum. Mm-hmm. And unless I want to filter rainwater through through ash, in which I can make my own. So that if the price of oil skyrockets to $200-$300 a barrel, then methanol does go up. But other than that, I'm able to keep the price approximately. So right now, with diesel in the Anchorage area, so I'm selling at about $3.50 a gallon. I sell the biodiesel between $2.75 and $3 a gallon.
Wow. And you bring tanks to people's homes, don't you? You'll set up a tank?
Chairman Ware, I can do that if that's requested.
Senator Wilkowski.
What's the amount of fish waste and the amount of gallons of diesel that you think you can create here in Alaska with the amount of fish waste that we have here in Alaska? Any sense?
Well, Chair, if I may defer that for just a minute, we have that in the presentation. I don't mean necessarily get ahead of it. One issue is how much could the state of Alaska generate?
Yeah.
The other question is how much did these 25 villages?
Yeah.
The 25 villages were about 4 million. The state of Alaska is a completely different issue. The state of Alaska has enough commercial fish waste for getting all of the subsistence and the communities we're talking about. There's enough commercial fish waste in the state of Alaska discarded every year to produce somewhere between 85 and 90 million gallons of diesel. The state of Alaska currently consumes 58 million gallons of diesel, all of which is imported. In the United States, as a whole, the United States, even if we only looked at 50%, recovering 50% of the commercial fishery waste, there's enough to equate to 10% of our national diesel needs per year. And that's just using this one waste product. We're about looking at any type of waste product, but just the fishery waste itself. But I have some more information on that a little bit later.
Yes, Senator Hoffman.
If this, if the information you give us on low sulfur substitute and a lot cheaper product, why isn't this being, this technology being implemented more widely throughout the United States and throughout the world?
To the Chair, Senator Hoffman. That's a misconception. Biodiesel is being widely implemented throughout the United States. Last year alone, 750 million gallons of biodiesel was produced in the United States and consumed. On the continent of Europe, 2.6 billion gallons of biodiesel were produced and consumed. And we're seeing with the mandates from seven other states, states such as Minnesota, Pennsylvania, et cetera, their mandate is all pump diesel within the next 2 years must be B20,
yes.
Which the B stands for the biodiesel. The number behind it is the percentage of biodiesel that's blended at the pump or to the pump. So by 2012, you're going to see a minimum of seven states, possibly more, that are going to be mandating a biodiesel blend for all consumers. So it is widely being used, and we're hoping to bring it to Alaska.
Through the chair, if I may add to that, please, sir.
I'd advise not interrupting the co-chairman of finance, but you could. It's up to you.
No, I was just going to add.
That's okay. Senator Hoffman.
And why many people say that this is unproven technology, and what's your response to that?
I had that, through the chair, we had that response from one individual. I made a call to the Undersecretary of Energy at the Department of Energy and asked him to send me some information provided to him. We also talked to the chairman of the biodiesel board because they have that kind of opinion all the time. And there's a variety of information that's available that helps people understand this product. This is an ASTM graded product. There's a mil spec for it. It's been in use for about
ASTM.
American Society of Testing and Materials. That's the standard by which any petroleum product, any fuel product, must meet certain requirements and needs. And it's generally because of lack of awareness about it. To kind of, if you look, there's been a very complex socioeconomic equation. People were using corn and soybean to make biodiesel until someone figured out that was actually part of the food chain and it became too expensive to use. They also built very large centralized facilities so that you had rail access to a plant in Ohio or in Nebraska, and they could bring in feedstock, dry material from everywhere. No one's really looked at doing, when you deal with a fishing community, you're dealing with either two kinds of places, either a more isolated location, such as the ones along coastal areas, or you're dealing with large farms. For example, we're working now, talking to a catfish farm in Alabama that last year buried 20 million gallons equivalent of fuel because they didn't know what to do with it. We're not fishermen and they're not biodiesel people, so we're trying to take advantage of this in our commercial business and move it forward and create sort of a center of excellence and knowledge about fish waste biodiesel in this state. But it's, as any product that's not mainstream, it's somewhat misunderstood. And I believe you mentioned that some places when they took the oil and mixed it with the biodiesel, and with diesel, and they called it biodiesel, and when that didn't work out, biodiesels tended to get a bad reputation when it really wasn't biodiesel at all.
Senator Hoffman, anything before you have to?
No.
Okay. Senator Huggin.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. question on logistics and transloading. For those fish processors that are offshore, I think I heard you say that the EPA is going to mandate that you just can't start dumping refuse. Is that true or false? Over
through the chair, Senator Huggins. It's our understanding from talking to fish processors and through EPA that they intend to, in the near future, severely limit or restrict altogether the ability for the processors to grind and discharge.
Right. So I guess said another way then, if do you see it within the logic and the logistics of taking offshore processor product and bring onshore to do biodiesel process with, or is the logistics that too far?
If through the chair, if I may, we've actually looked at that issue, and part of our solution was to come up with a design of a product that would fit in a 20-foot 8x8 shipping container. Most of the ships have the ability, the ones that currently either take the fillets off and dump the product now, may have a support vessel with them. It's very easy to take this refinery design and put it on a ship and do it at sea and extend their fishing season, or then have to containerize resulting fuel. They would still have the issue of what to do with the waste they dump. But if you de-oiled it, you've already substantially reduced the amount of pathogenic material growth that's possible. So, and when we say that the EPA is looking at this, we all know that that may take a decade before they actually legislate something like that. So,
okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Absolutely. And Senator French and then Wagner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my question, and I don't want to jump to the end of your presentation, but at some level, I guess I'm starting to ask myself, you know, what's the catch? There must be, you know, something out here, like the cost of this of your modules or something that is, you know, prohibitive. And so I guess I'd ask you to sort of make the case for just tell me maybe what the main impediment to this process is, or this idea.
Through the chair, if I may, we were asked to do a study to come up with a solution to a problem. And we want to make sure it's doing well. This has nothing to do with our business. We're going to continue doing our business and what we're doing. We were asked to estimate, you know, what would it cost to do a couple of pilot plants, to do all 25 plants, to build out the infrastructure, two plants, and the infrastructure over a couple of years would probably cost about $6 million. To do one plant would be about $3.5 million. Incrementally, each plant would cost about $2.5 million. But if you're making 100,000 to 600,000 gallons, the payback is less than a year and a half on that. Our recommendation, and it's a little bit later in here, was basically to, do you have an idea for a solution to reducing this cost and helping these rural communities? And we just have a suggestion, a proposal that we came up with that we think is an elegant proposal, but it's not something that you could go to any number of firms to have them participate and do this activity. We were just asked as domain experts to provide a suggestion to how it could work. We're also, and we apologize, but we're not state financial. We don't know what the appropriate mechanism the state would want to fund a nonprofit to run this. That we felt was the appropriate decision of the legislators or the people involved in the different programs to figure out if it was a useful activity, how they would want to manage it, how it would go forward. So our objective was to try to provide a solution to an issue, not to ask for anything. We're not here asking for anything. Sir.
And thank you, and I appreciate that. And so I guess my only follow-up is I've got this document, and is that where is this proposal written down?
Through the chair, we made three documents. One document was, and you'll notice the page numbering is a little bit off in this document because we removed four pages.
Oh, okay.
And those four pages, because it's not the purview, as I understand, of the committee to worry about how you would fund something, we removed that just to make this an informational briefing. That's what we were asked to do. We do have those.
And are they distributed under separate cover? Or?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you very much.
Wagner and then Senator Wilikowski.
First, forewarning, we don't import a lot of diesel in Alaska. Diesel's made in North Pole and in Chicago, Argentina. Most of the low sulfur diesel is made here in Alaska. You said that it's imported. I don't know what you meant by that.
I apologize. That was the information that was given to us by the police. Yeah. So we can go to confirm.
Yeah,
that.
They gave us some bad info. But secondly, are these plants need to be in place more or less permanently, I would think, then, for the full period of time that the fish are being harvested and the waste being generated? In other words, you can't let this waste sit an amount of time and then bring a plant in and process it. I'm thinking about portability.
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, no. These are permanent locations.
Okay.
The challenge is that, you know, the fish degrades very quickly if you don't have a way to either immediately process it, which is what we do, or to store it.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the way I sort of envision something like this taking off would be through our emerging technology fund, which we're looking into in an omnibus bill. And if we could get one of these going somewhere in Alaska, Alaska could be a pioneer in this, sort of like Senator McGuire was saying in a conversation we just had. This could be something like in the Midwest. They didn't used to make corn to a large degree into diesel or soybeans, and Alaska could really become this. We could become a pioneer in this. That's sort of the way I envision this. But the opportunity to provide extremely low cost diesel fuel for many of our rural villages for very, very low cost with what appears to be a payback in a year or a year and a half is something we really need to look into.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, you've hit exactly on my talking points. It is a very low cost fuel. It enables the rural communities to create their own source of fuel rather than having to import the fuel. And in all due respect, that was bad information we were given, Senator Wagner, so thank you. Furthermore, the ability, you hit it right on the head as far as Alaska to be a technological leader and a center for excellence, not only for the production of fish waste biodiesel, which, as we stated earlier, there's only two other locations in the world that are doing that. It's a small Honduras company. And now a Finnish company that is building a plant in Vietnam for the channel catfish. But we'd also be a center of excellence for economic development by imposing setting up these small, right-scale refineries in the rural communities. So,
absolutely. Fish just sent me a note and said the blended tax credit of 2004 gave a $1 per gallon subsidy for fish diesel expired in 2008. Are there any new subsidies on the horizon that, that you're aware of?
My understanding, my last discussion with the Department of Energy was that they don't have a well-consensed energy strategy going forward yet. They're in the process of understanding whether there's going to be a stimulus package and whether or not part of stimulus two would include those subsidies, whether that would be part of one of the energy bills that are going through right now. We work with the Department of Energy and Congressman Peters and Senator Stabenow on some of the language that they put into their last $3 billion energy bill to allow that to be a consideration on a state-by-state basis. But they have not decided whether there's going to be a federal mandate yet, and my understanding is they won't know till later this year, approximately August, when they get through many of the committee meetings.
Keep us posted. And then just another point, you might include, if you haven't and I haven't gotten to, the cost of the low sulfur diesel that is being produced but at a small scale at the refinery in Tesoro, I understand, is much more expensive. And yet we have these mandates on the horizon. I've looked into, and we're trying to get back data on what our own Department of Transportation is doing. We understand that they are slowly easing into the low sulfur diesel with respect to their fleet, but it's very, very expensive. So one of the things you might look at too is the cost comparison between low sulfur diesel and the biodiesel itself, because that will be the world that we're looking at. And just to remind everybody, what we know is we did this with gasoline in the late 70s. We said we are going to pull out those environment harming elements and just require it to be refined down. And we didn't do it with diesel at the time, and now we have that push. And so I don't see us going back from that movement. That's the way the world looks now. It will be that low sulfur diesel. So just even comparing apples to apples, I think you might consider what is the cost of low sulfur diesel refined from here versus the biodiesel itself. So, and we'll, this today was meant to just be, you've been around talking in offices, but I wanted members to get an opportunity. Bill and I and others have got exposed to it, and it's very exciting when you think about the potential for recouping the investment that the state would make on so many levels, from job training, energy production, independence in villages. It's the kind of thing that we've really been looking at. So we'll look forward to hearing updates from you. And as Bill said, what I think ends up being right for it is this, the formerly Senate Bill 150, but now in our energy plan, the concept of emerging energy technology. So it's that energy technology that sits right on the edge and, again, could make us a world leader in it. So are there any further questions at this time? Okay. So we'll let you continue through. We've probably...
We can give you time, Chairman. We can kind of go through a little of this quickly. What I have on this next sheet was a picture of typically what the type of biodiesel refineries are that we look at on a commercial basis. Okay. These are about 1 million gallons.
And tell us costs, too, if you can.
Yes. Those generally cost us in between the range of $8 to $15 million, depending on how many gallons they're putting out.
Okay.
This facility that we're looking at, the design idea, we went back to some designs that were made in Germany and in Belgium, which are these two particulars. They run by about 2.2 million to 2.4 million, and they produce between sort of a minimum of 100,000 gallons up to about 600,000 gallons. What's not shown in here is that you would have to have the fish rendering equipment to process it down, which is that high-speed garbage disposal, and some handling off the back end, as well as some external tanks. But these both fit in 20-foot, 8x8-foot shipping containers, meaning you could barge them out or, in some cases, fly them out to the locations that are desired. The next page.
Yeah, that's an important question, too, is whether or not you can ship all of the pieces in.
Chairman McGuire, the nice thing about those, let me go back up to that slide, is because they are already, they're made into a ship, essentially a shipping container.
Yeah.
So they can either go on barges or, believe it or not, they fit in the back of a C-130. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and they can be transported easily to the communities.
Senator, we looked at a whole solution when we were asked to do this because I got in touch with a company, Whitehorse, that has the contract for building the housing that would go in the pipeline area. Yeah. And asked them for some information. And basically, they're looking at housing that would also fit into a container that could be, with unskilled labor, unfolded, removed from the container, and build a facility that's big enough to house not only this equipment, but in many cases, there are other activities that occur in these communities that it would allow them to have a loft space to do community activities. So we're trying to come up with how do you get the most out of a package, if you will. And so those kinds of things, it's also self-sufficient. It doesn't require water. It uses its own fuel to run itself after an initial startup, and it could be used just tied to other generators just to provide a whole community-based or a separate industry-based power. So there's a variety of options that could be done with this. I have a summary chart that basically tried to encapsulate what our goal was in coming up with a solution, and that was to consume a locally generated waste as a feedstock to produce biodiesel for local consumption, produce no unusable waste, effluent or pollution, no water, no solid that couldn't be resold or created something. It would train and employ residents of rural communities and understand that these systems are no more complex than doing maintenance on a snowmobile. I mean, if you can change the oil in it, you start it.
Senator Wagner.
What happens if some of this is spilled on water?
Through the chair, Senator Wagner. This biodiesel is so non-toxic that one tablespoon of salt is more toxic to the water than 10,000 gallons of biodiesel.
Okay. So I can pump my bilge.
I'm sorry?
So if I got some in my bilge, I could pump my bilge.
Correct.
It also would diversify the industry base and increase the skills of these communities. And this design that we've looked at, basically you can scale it with a little bit of work up or down to meet anywhere from the lower end of 100,000 up to the 600,000. Some of the direct benefits that allow, and again, we only address these 25 high candidate communities, high potential communities. Wind may be more appropriate for other communities, wave power for others, but for fishing communities, this would help the state decrease or eliminate the energy subsidies that they pay over time. It would incubate a new industry. The villages would have to provide some type of plant site, but they would obtain from that an environmentally friendly fuel. They would employ new people with more people with new skill sets and reduce the reliance on an imported, in this case means imported to their community, the imported fuel. And I think we've covered the rest of the items, so I won't reproduce those here. We've been asked to kind of estimate, well, how many jobs would this create, being that we don't necessarily view this as a biofuels program. We view it as an economic development initiative. Each village biorefinery would ultimately employ from 4 to 8 people at the high level, at the 5 to 600,000 gallon level. A training and certification center, which we've been working with the University of Alaska at Fairbanks to help identify and create, would probably employ between 6 to 10 university personnel, most of which would be student that are doing the training, learning it as part of a course program. A central chemicals and spares warehouse and a couple of field staff and an office employee would employ another 8 to 10. And of course, you then have all the collateral employment growth in transportation and chemical and other industries that participate in this. To give you an idea of how green this product is, B100 is 100% biodiesel, is the cleanest known fuel based on the Argonne National Laboratory's analysis of how much energy it takes to recover something from its source all the way through usage. And this is actually data that I took from the comparison of alternative fuels by the Department of Energy. This next chart probably shows some more important information. EPA looked at the exhaust emissions from the product that we produced and from their own analysis, and compared to petroleum, there's 101% less pollution. And the reason it's more than 100% is because every other fuel, you are required to go get the feedstock in terms of the stalks or the rapeseed and process it and regrow it, refertilize it, rewater it, whereas, as Greg mentioned, this feedstock swims back to you every year, and whether something's done or not with biodiesel, they're still going to go out and collect the fish. So it's a question that it's already a waste, so you don't have that energy cost to go harvest the actual original point of harvesting.
If you look at some of the other numbers on here that are really important, especially in today's political climates and everything, you see the CO2 reductions of 96.8%, the N2O, the nitrous oxide, down 15, or the nitrous oxide actually goes up slightly with biodiesel production. But you see greenhouse gases down 95.3%. The big number that jumps out there, and people always ask, well, there's something that goes up 338.2%. And that is actually the DOL fish waste that we then turn into fertilizer. So that's why that number is so large. You see the carbon monoxide is down 85%, and particulate matter, which is the less than 10 micrometers, down 162.3%, and the bigger stuff is, or less than that, is 86.3% down.
Senator Wagner.
Can you back up one slide?
Yes, sir.
I understand gasoline being where it's at on that bar chart, but I don't understand LPG and compressed natural gas being almost as high as gasoline. I don't know where those figures came from, but compressed natural gas and liquid petroleum are much lower in emissions than diesel, as far as greenhouse gases.
This, and that's a good call. People ask the same question about electric. The reason isn't the actual burning of the emission from the vehicle. It's because the way that the Department of Energy calculates total greenhouse gas emissions, they count how much pollution is given off to recover the original fuel, to transport it, to store it, to harvest it, and then, and so no matter, for example, electrics aren't even in there because the lithium batteries in any battery.
I understand where you come from now. Mm-hmm.
Just a
funny math.
Senator French.
Well, just to follow up, so you're saying this is a life cycle sort of approach to greenhouse gas emissions, or sort of total, from cradle to grave, so to speak, or?
For the chair, we use the what's called the GREETS model, which is what Argonne National Lab created for the Department of Energy that goes from wellhead to pump.
And these are DOE numbers here we're seeing?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
One of those PennWare conferences we had, they had a DOE booth set up, and they asked you to chart where you'd driven from, et cetera, and they did your carbon footprint, and it was pretty illustrative. Those of us from Alaska had a pretty high one, and we decided we were replaceable, we thought, probably by somebody else, but then not by our minds, but yeah, so that's kind of the new trend. Well, thank you so much. Are there any final questions from the committee? Very exciting. Senator Wagner.
Yeah, one of your earlier slides showed or talked about you're going to do something on the peninsula or put a plant in, or you were looking at putting a plant in or something.
Through the chair, Senator Wagner. It talked about the plant on the Kenai Peninsula. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, get what it said exactly.
To the chair.
Build a fish waste biodiesel refinery in the Kenai Peninsula.
Correct. Any questions, then?
Is that a project that you are undertaking or are going to undertake, or somebody else is?
That is a project that we are currently undertaking.
Okay. And that's all. And this goes back to Senator Huggins' question. I don't think I got a full answer from you. But he's talking about offshore processors and the waste from offshore processors. Here you're talking about onshore processors. And I don't think they're going to make the offshore processors bring their waste into shore, are they?
It's our understanding, Senator, that yes, even the offshore processors will not be able to grind and discharge. That's what we've been told. Whether or not that, it's not a final decision from the EPA yet, but that's what we've been told, is that due to the fact that what is ground and discharge is not being, it's not decomposing at the depths that they deposit into the ocean, and the fact that it was originally thought that other sea life would consume this ground and discharge material, and that's not happening as well. Mm. So, and I got this information from EPA individuals that were willing to speak off the record, and then also as well as from processing managers themselves that have said, we foresee a day in the very near future when they're not going to allow us to grind and discharge, period.
You know, that's true. They don't consume the ground. If they wouldn't grind it and jump it out, then it would be consumed.
That's true.
I mean, that's true. That's okay. Any processor or fisherman understands and knows that. Crazy what we're doing to ourselves.
The world we live in, huh?
Chairman, if I may, we would like to thank you for the opportunity to present this study.
Absolutely. Thank
very
you.
Very interesting presentation.
It is. It's very exciting. We're all trying to find energy solutions for Alaska, particularly rural Alaska, and we appreciate it. We look forward to talking to you in the future. We're adjourned.
Thank you.